The Little People.
They're here!
Jacob was so choked with excitement, his voice cracked and went all warbly.
The Breakers are bloody here!
All the days and weeks and months waiting, and now he stared wildly around their little parlour, with his hands opening and closing, hardly knowing what to do first. Petrie didn't look excited. She looked worried, sour even. The lads had warned him he was marrying a sour woman, but he hadn't seen it then. He'd always been a hoper. "You're a hoper," they'd said. Now, every day, she seemed more sour. But this was hardly the time to be fretting about his marriage.
"They're bloody here!"
When he grabbed his coat, he sent pamphlets scattering off the table. Wasn't as if he'd read them. Wasn't as if he could read, really. But having them felt like a fine step towards freedom. And who needed pamphlets when the Breakers were come in person? He went to fetch his grandfather's sword from the hook above the fire, hissed a curse that Petrie had made him hang it out of reach, had to go up on tiptoes to get the damn thing down, and near dropped it on his head. He felt bad when he saw her face. Maybe she wasn't sour so much as scared. That's what the bastards wanted, the Inquisition and the closed council, everyone scared. He caught her by the shoulder, tried to shake some of his hope into her.
"Price of bread'll go down now," he said. "You'll see, bread for everyone."
"You think so?"
"I know so."
She put her fingertips on the battered scabbard.
"Don't take the sword. Having it might make you try to use it. You don't know how."
"I know how,"
he snapped, though they both knew he didn't, not really. And he wrenched it from her hand, twisted it the wrong way up, and the rust-spotted blade slithered halfway out of the scabbard before he caught it and slapped it back in.
"A man should be armed on the day of the great change. Enough of us have 'em, we won't need to use 'em."
And before she could voice any more doubts, he dashed out, letting the door clatter against the frame. The streets were bright outside, everything glossy and gleaming and seeming new-made after the rain just fallen. People everywhere, somewhere between a riot and a carnival. People running, people shouting, some faces he knew, most were strangers. A woman grabbed him around the neck, kissed him on the cheek. A whore stood on some railings, clinging to the side of a building with one hand, pulling her dress up with the other to give the crowd an eyeful.
"Half price all day," she screeched.
He'd been ready to fight, ready to charge ranks of royalist spears, freedom and equality as his armour. Petrie had not cared for that idea, and honestly, he'd been having some doubts of his own as the day grew closer. But he only saw a few soldiers, and they had smiles on their faces and jackets hanging open, cheering and jumping and celebrating like everyone else. Someone was singing, someone was crying, someone was dancing in puddles, spraying everyone. Someone lay in a doorway, drunk, maybe. Then Jacob saw blood on their face. Maybe he should help. But he was swept along by people running. Couldn't tell why. Couldn't tell anything. Out onto the sparway that cut wide through the mills of the three farms towards the centre of the city. He saw armed men there, polished armour, brand new and glittering. He froze at the corner, heart in his mouth, sword half hidden behind his back, thinking they must be King's Own. Then he saw their bearded faces and their swaggering gait and the banners they carried, roughly stitched with broken chains, and he knew this was the people's army marching to freedom. Workers were pouring from the manufactories to join the throng, and he pushed through them, laughing and shouting himself hoarse. He clambered around a cannon, a bloody cannon, wheeled along by grinning dye women, their forearms stained strange colours. Folk sang and embraced and wept, and Jacob wasn't a shoemaker any more, but a fighter for justice, a proud brother of the Breakers, struggling in the great endeavour of the age. He saw a woman at the head of the crowd on a white horse wearing a soldier's breastplate. Judge! Had to be judge! More beautiful and furious and righteous through the blurring tears in his eyes than he dared to hope. A spirit she was, an idea made into flesh, a goddess leading the people to their destiny.
Brothers! Sisters! To the Agriant!
And she pointed up the road towards freedom.
I've a fancy to greet his august fucking majesty!
And there was another raucous wave of laughter and delight, and down an alley Jacob thought he saw some men kicking someone on the ground over and over, and he drew his grandfather's rusty sword and lifted it high in the air and joined in with the singing.
"They're here," whispered Grey.
Captain Leeb drew his sword, felt like the right thing to do.
"I am aware, Corporal."
He tried to project an air of confidence. Confidence defines an officer. He remembered his brother telling him so.
"I can hear them."
Judging by the noise, there was a considerable number of them. A considerable number and steadily approaching. It put Leeb in mind of the crowd's clamour at the contest. Hundreds of voices raised in delighted excitement. Thousands of voices. But there was a definite edge of madness to it, a touch of fury, an occasional punctuation of shattering glass, splintering wood. Leeb would have very much liked to run away. He didn't want anyone's blood on his hands, especially not his own. And he wasn't without sympathy for their cause, up to a point. Freedom and justice and so on. Who doesn't like that stuff in principle? But he had sworn an oath to the king. Not to the king directly, of course, but, you know, he'd sworn it even so. He'd been happy to swear it when things were going well, and supposed he couldn't just unswear it the moment things turned dicey. What kind of an oath would it be then? His colonel had assured him help was coming, from the king's own, then from Westport, then from Starrickland, from ever less likely directions. But no help appeared to have arrived at all. Leeb glanced at his men, spread out across the width of the sparway. What a flimsy little red line they looked. Perhaps 40 flat bowmen, 80 spearmen. Half of his company hadn't come out. Somewhat looser in their oaths than he was. He'd always thought there was no more admirable quality than being a man of your word. Loyalty defines an officer. His father had often told him so. But it was starting to look as if a certain elasticity could be a useful thing.
"They're here," whispered Grey again. "I am aware, Corporal."
Leeb's mouth turned very dry as the murk from the foundry down the street was thinned out by the breeze.
"I can see them."
More of them, indeed, and more. Many looked like ordinary citizens, women and children among them, brandishing chair legs and hammers and knives and spears made from mops. Others looked like professionals, armour and bright weapons glinting as the sun peeped through. Leeb's jaw slowly dropped as he began to appreciate the sheer number of them. Plainly, the closed council's increasingly shrill proclamations, curfews, threats, examples had not achieved the desired effect. Quite the reverse.
"By the fates,"
someone muttered.
"Steady,"
said Leeb, but it came out a squeak that couldn't have steadied anyone. It might have unsteadied those already steady, indeed. It was painfully obvious that his brittle little line had no chance of stopping that boiling tide, no chance at all. When they saw Leeb and his soldiers, they wobbled to a halt, bunching up uncertainly, chants and cheers dying on their lips. There was an intensely awkward silence, and an inappropriate memory floated up from the depths of Leeb's mind. The intensely awkward silence after he, drunk, had tried to kiss his cousin Cithrin at that dance, and she jerked away in horror, so he ended up sort of kissing her ear. This silence was like that one, but a great deal more terrifying. What to do? By the fates, what to do? Let them through? Join them? Fight them? Run and never stop? There were no good ideas. Leib's lower lip twitched stupidly, but no sound emerged. Even a least bad idea was beyond him. Decisiveness defines an officer, but he hadn't been trained for this. They don't train you for the world suddenly coming unravelled. And now a rider pushed through to the front of the throng, a woman with a tangle of damp red hair and a furious sneer. It was as if her rage was an infection, spreading instantly through the crowd. Faces twisted, weapons lifted, screams and cries and taunts burst forth, and suddenly Leib had no choice at all. "Raise bows!" he spluttered. Almost as if running out of time to think of a better idea, he was left only with this self-evidently terrible one. His men glanced at each other, stirred uncomfortably. "Raise bows!" roared Corporal Grey, veins bulging from his thick neck. At the same time, he looked at Leib with a vaguely desperate expression. The pilot of a foundering vessel, perhaps, looking to his captain, silently asking if they really did intend to go down with the ship. Perhaps that's why captains do go down with their ships. No better ideas.
"Shoot!"
squeaked Leib, chopping downwards with his sword. He wasn't sure how many actually shot. Less than half. Afraid to shoot at so many? Unwilling to shoot at men who might have been their fathers, brothers, sons? Women who might have been their mothers, sisters, daughters? A couple shot high, on purpose or in haste. There was a scream. Did two or three fall in the front rank of that seething mob? It made not the slightest difference. How could it? The terrifying she-devil at the front stabbed towards Leib with a clawing finger.
"Kill those fuckers!"
And they charged in their hundreds. Leib was a reasonably brave man, a reasonably honourable man, a reasonable monarchist who took his oath to his king very seriously. But Leib was not a fool. He turned and ran with his men. It was not a company anymore, but a squealing, jostling, whimpering herd of pigs. Someone shoved him and he fell, rolled. He thought it might have been Corporal Grey, damn him. They all were scattering now, tossing their weapons, and he scrambled towards an alleyway, barging past a surprised-looking beggar and nearly falling again. How could one man keep his oath when everyone else was breaking theirs, after all? An army very much relied on unity of purpose. Run for the Agrient, that was all he could think of. He plunged through the crooked back streets, his neck prickling with fear, his breath sawing at his chest. Damn weak lungs, he'd been cursed with them all his life. "Can you name a Lord Marshal with weak lungs?" his brother used to ask. "Lungs define an officer." Adua's foul vapours hardly helped. He sagged into a doorway, trying to suppress his cough. He'd dropped his sword somewhere, or had he thrown it away?
"Bloody hell!"
He stared down at his officer's jacket. Bright red. How could it be redder? The whole purpose was to make him stand out like a bullseye on a target. He stumbled from the doorway, struggling with the brass buttons, and almost straight into a group of heavy-set men. Workers, maybe, from one of the foundries in the neighbourhood. But there was a wildness in their eyes, whites showing stark in their grease-smeared faces. They stared at him, and he at them.
"Now listen," he said, raising one weak hand. "I was just doing..."
They were not interested. Not in his duty, or his oath, or his sympathy for their cause, or his reasonable monarchism. It was not a day for the reasonable, let alone for whatever defines an officer. One of them put his head down and charged. Lieb managed to throw a single punch as he came, a harmless one, which missed the mark and bounced off the man's forehead. His brother had once told him how to punch, but he hadn't really been listening. He wished he'd listened now. But then his brother hadn't really known anything about punching either. The man caught Lieb in the side with his shoulder, knocked his wind out, lifted him bodily, and brought him down on the wet cobbles with a stunning crash. Then they were all on him, kicking, swearing, slavering madmen, furious animals. Lieb curled up as best he could, whimpering at each blow. Something hit him so hard in the back he was sick. To his horror, he saw one of them take out a knife. It was a shock when Cal pulled the blade. Maybe it shouldn't have been. Dawes knew he carried one. He stopped kicking the officer to stare at it, thought about shouting at him not to do it, but by then Cal was stabbing. "Shit," whispered Dawes. Hadn't planned on killing anyone when he left his spot in the mill and ran out to join the breakers flooding down the sparway. Not sure what he had been planning. Setting things right, maybe? Getting a fair deal for once? Not this, anyway. They all looked shocked, Cal most of all. "Had to be done," he said, staring down at the poor bastard, wheezing and spitting blood and leaking red all over the street. "Had to be done." Dawes didn't see why. Wasn't like this fool had set their wages. They could have given him a kicking, taught him a lesson, left it at that. But whether it had to be done or not, it was done now, no undoing it. "Come on." Dawes turned, left the dying officer behind, started hurrying back towards the sparway, towards the Agreant. Didn't know what had happened when they got there. Just like they hadn't known what had happened when they started kicking that officer. Regrets were for tomorrow. "They're here." Shawley watched a set run down the alley below, footsteps clapping from the fronts of the narrow buildings, and he tossed back the last of his wine and swung his legs from the window seat.
"Who's here?"
slurred Rill, her eyes all unfocused from the husk.
"The breakers, you fucking dunce!"
And he planted his hand on her face and shoved her back onto the bed. She caught her head on the headboard as she fell and put fingers to her scalp, and the tips came away bloody, and Shawley had to burst out laughing. He'd always been quite the joker. He took his hatchet from the table and slid the haft up his sleeve.
"Good time to settle some scores, I reckon."
And he perched his hat on his head at just the right angle, straightened his collar in the mirror, took one last pinch of pearl dust, then trotted jauntily down the stairs and out into the street. There was an explosive feel to the air, a feel of things ripped up so they could be put back together a new way. A woman ran past him screaming, or maybe laughing, and Shawley tipped his hat to her. He was known for his good manners. Then he stood out of the way so some men could dash by, gripping his axe all the while. Just in case, you understand. He wasn't the only one with scores to settle, and Shawley had a lot of enemies. Always had a talent for making them. He passed a ragged old couple stripping a dead officer, lying in a slick of blood, and swaggered on, keeping his head down, sticking to the back streets and the shortcuts. Always had a knack for finding his way. He'd been worried that getting through Arnold's wall might be a problem, been thinking about slipping through the sewers, though it would have ruined the nice boots he'd stolen off that merchant. But the sable gate stood wide open. Must have been a fight there, a crowd dragging the bloody corpses of some king's own up onto the walls. The guts were hanging out of one. The head was off another. Shawley had no clue where it might have ended up. Seemed impolite to ask. He tipped his hat to a hideous woman with no more than 4 teeth in her head and slipped through the gate. He could hear the violence further on, the mad noise spreading through the richer districts inside Arnold's wall. They might call it the People's Army, and there might be a few high principles tossed about, but if you wanted his opinion, there were plenty of thugs with pretty excuses mixed in, and no small number who weren't even bothering with the excuses, just turning a quick profit from the chaos. Evidence of their handiwork all over. Surely stopped to filch a nice ring off a corpse that someone had left begging. Always been blessed with sharp eyes. He saw the house. How often had he stood outside in the shadows planning his revenge? Now, thanks to happy circumstances, it dropped in his lap and he just had to catch it. The gate was locked, but he slipped off his coat and tossed it over the railings on top of the wall while no one was looking. He took a run up and jumped over, slipped through the wet garden where the bushes were clipped to look like birds or some such. Bloody waste of money if he wanted his opinion. Money that should have been his. The dining room window still didn't lock properly, and Shawley eased it open, slipped over the sill, and dropped down silent in the darkened room on the other side. Always had a knack for treading softly. Place hadn't changed much. Dark table and chairs, dark dresser with the silver plate gleaming. Silver plate that should have been his. He heard laughter, talking, more laughter. A woman's voice, he thought. A young woman, an older man. They'd no idea what was happening in the city yet, by the sound of it. Strange that 50 strides from the madness, it could be just an ordinary day. He padded down the corridor and peered around a doorframe. It was an odd scene, given the carnage in the streets. A girl of 20 with a mass of blonde hair stood admiring herself in a mirror of viscerine glass, which must have cost more in Shawley's house. She wore a half-made dress of shining fabric, two seamstresses attending to her, a young one with a mouthful of pins, and an old one on her knees, busy stitching at a hem. Furnivelt sat in a corner, wine glass in his hand. He had his back to Shawley, but you could see him smiling in the mirror as he watched it all done. And Shawley realised the girl must be Furnivelt's daughter. That was how long he'd been waiting. Should have just killed the old bastard where he sat, but Shawley wanted him to know. So he stepped around the doorframe and tipped his hat. "Ladies," he said, smirking into the mirror, and they turned to look, puzzled. Not scared yet, that had come. Shawley couldn't remember her name, Furnivelt's daughter, but she'd turned out so pretty. That's what happens when you grow up with all these advantages. These advantages that should have been his. "Shawley?" Furnivelt jumped from his chair, a delicious shock across his face. "I thought I told you never to come back here." "You told me a lot of things." Shawley let the axe slide from his sleeve so he was gripping the haft. "You self-righteous old shit." And he hit him on the side of the head. Furnivelt got his hand up and knocked it wide, but the blade still caught his scalp, blood flying across the room. He made a funny little gasp, stumbled, dropped his wine glass, and it broke across the floor. One of the dressmakers screamed, pins falling from her open mouth. Furnivelt's daughter stared, the tendons starting from her pale bare feet. Second time, Shawley caught Furnivelt right between the eyes, axe sinking into his skull with a bang. The dressmaker screamed again. Bloody irritating scream she had. Furnivelt's daughter sprinted out, fast as a ferret, given she had all that half-stitched cloth about her. "Damn it!" Shawley had to get her, too, to make it fair. But the axe was stuck fast in Furnivelt's skull, and however he tugged, it wouldn't come free.
"Get back here, bitch!"
Lilotte ran. There was no thought involved. She fled in terror down the hall, spurred on by the shrieks of her dressmakers. She fumbled with the locks, plunged across the gardens, crashed through the gate. She ran, clutching up the gauzy skirts of her unfinished wedding dress, her bare feet slapping at the wet cobbles. She burst into the square. People everywhere. People shocked, joyous, curious, furious. Strange people with strange intensities of emotion, twisting their pale faces into animal masks. Where had they come from? A man stood on a packing crate, screaming something about votes. Leering labourers bellowed back at him. A woman with wild hair bounced on a big man's shoulders, shaking a sword and swearing at the sky. Lilotte had been about to scream for help, but some instinct made her bite her lip and shrink against the wall, trying to catch her breath. She hardly knew what had happened. The Breakers, she supposed. It must be the Breakers. She once listened to one of them give a speech, hidden at the back of a meeting in a shawl she borrowed from her maid. She had thought it such a daring thing to do, had been expecting fire and fury and, well, danger. But it had all sounded so reasonable. Fair pay, equitable hours, decent treatment. She had hardly been able to understand why everyone was so afraid of them. Later, flushed and eager, she had repeated all the arguments to her father. He had told her she had no notion of the complexities of managing a labour market, that what seemed to her eminent good sense might sound to some ears like treason, and that this was not the kind of thing the lady of taste he was raising her to be would ever need to worry about. In that much, at least, he had been horribly mistaken. She limped down a crowded street. The sun had gone in and a chilly gust brought a new sprinkle of rain. Someone was playing a fiddle far too fast, and they danced and whooped and clapped like guests at a particularly wild party. And not far away, a well-dressed corpse was draped over a railing, blood dripping from its broken skull and trickling in the gutter. Was her father dead? She gave a kind of moan, had to bite her knuckle to keep from screaming. There had been warning signs. The price of bread and meat, she heard from the cook, kept going up. Loyalty in the army, she heard from Harbin, kept going down. There had been that uprising in Valbek. Vague worries that there might be more when the rebels landed in Midland. News of the king's victory had brought relief, but then came the rumours of breakers approaching Adua. Then came the curfew, then the arrests by the Inquisition, then the hangings by the closed council. She had suggested they postpone the wedding, but her father was as deaf to that as he had been to the Breakers' arguments. He refused to put off his only child's happiness on account of a crowd of ruffians. Harbin laughed at the notion that the capital could fall to an army of peasants. So Lilotte forced out laughter too, since agreeing with your husband-to-be was expected of a young lady, at least before the marriage. They had convinced themselves it would not happen. They had been horribly mistaken on that score, too. She hardly recognised the streets she had grown up in, flooded with crazed humanity, surging on invisible currents of joy and fury. She was so cold, not exactly crying, but her eyes and her nose constantly leaking, her bare shoulders clammy from the drizzle, and her bare feet bruised from the unforgiving cobblestones. Her breath came in terrified whoops, her skin crawling under her half-finished, pearl-stitched bodice. Only that morning it had felt so important that all the right guests should accept their invitations, that the words of their vows be perfect, that the hem of her dress was stitched just so. Now the hem of her dress was black with road filth, and, fates help her, speckled brown with her father's blood, and all the world was turned upside down and inside out. She hobbled on, not knowing where she was or where she was heading. Some unsewn flap of her dress caught on a broken fence as she ran past and nearly jerked her off her bare feet. Someone laughed at her. Another clapped. On any other day, a desperate, barefooted girl in a blood-spattered wedding dress would have excited some attention. Today, it was nothing to remark upon. The whole city had gone mad. The whole world. Over the roofs, she glimpsed the parapet of the Tower of Chains, the tallest tower of the Agrient, and she gave a moan of relief. But when she burst gasping onto the paving stones beside the moat, it became a groan of horror. She had wandered lazily across this bridge on happy summer days among the wealthy revellers, on her way to the Agriance Park to see and be seen, to applaud the fencers at the summer contest. She remembered smiling at floating ducklings following their mother in dignified single file, remembered counting the green and red and purple lily pads with Harbin on the day he proposed. So picturesque. The gates were sealed now. People were crushed against them, waving frantically, wailing at the towering gatehouse to be let in. An old woman in a very fine dress was scratching at the wood with her fingernails. Lilotte added her voice to the rest as she staggered across the bridge. She hardly knew what else to do.
"Help!" she screeched. "Help!"
She saw a pale man with a red scarf staring past her and spun about to follow his eyes. A crowd was coming up the wide middle way, banners bobbing over it, steels of pikes and armour glinting.
"Oh no,"
she whispered. She could not run any more. There was nowhere left to run to. A house was on fire, smoke rolling from the upstairs windows into the spitting sky. People began to scatter, knocking each other down, trampling each other in their mindless haste. Lilotte took an elbow in the face and tottered back, tasting blood. Her foot caught in her torn dress, the parapet hit her in the knees, and with a despairing gasp, she tumbled over. It was not that far to the moat, but even so, the water hit her hard, knocked out her breath, and sucked her down in a rush of bubbles. The floating glory of her dress became an instant dead weight, fabric clutching at her, dragging her down. She was beyond exhaustion, beyond terror. Part of her wanted just to sink, but another would not let her go, made her thrash, kick, struggle. She came up, coughing dirty water, wriggled through the clutching, slapping lily pads, far less picturesque at close quarters, and into the darkness under the bridge. She pressed herself to the slimy stones, hair plastered across her face, her head full of the smell of vegetable rot. Not far away, a corpse floated, face down. A hint of sodden cloth, of tangled hair. She watched it turn slowly, bump against the moss-covered wall of the moat, drift away. She wondered who it had been. She wondered who she was now. She wondered if she would live out the hour. Everything was changed. The People's Army was coming. Wasn't she the people too? When had she become their enemy? She squeezed her eyes shut, shivering in the icy water, and gave up trying to smother her own sobs. No one could have heard them over the deafening noise of the mob above. Tramping boots, clashing metal, breaking glass, rumbling wagon wheels. A demon with many voices.
"Bread! Give us bread!
Send out the closed council!
The great change has come!
Let us in, you fuckers!
Let us in, or we break in!"
And louder than all, a sawing, maddened shriek.
"Bring out his fucking majesty!
Bring him out!"
screamed Mother Mostly, shoving forward. They'd made it to the Agriant, ready to seize their own justice for once, rather than be crushed by the kings. But now folk held up. From some shred of respect for their old masters, or fear of them at least, they loitered at the head of the bridge.
"There's men up there," someone said. "King's men with bows."
Mother Mostly's eyesight weren't near good enough to see any king's men that far off. The whole gatehouse was a looming blur over the heads of the folk packed in front. The king's men couldn't kill this whole crowd, but no doubt they could kill a few, and no one was eager to be first. But Mother Mostly wouldn't be fucking bullied. Her father had tried it when she was a girl, and she'd stabbed him with a knitting needle and run away from home. Her first husband had tried it, and she'd stabbed him with a butcher's knife and rolled his body into the canal. The Styrians had tried it when they came to put their boot across the arches. They'd come asking for money, and she'd told them to go back where they fucking came from. They'd beaten her, but she healed. They'd cut two of her fingers off, and she got her hands back in the soap the same day. They'd smashed her doors, smashed her shutters, smashed her tubs, but she got new ones. In the end, their boss turned up, and she was sure he'd kill her, but he gave her a nod of respect instead. She needn't pay, he'd said. She alone. It was just a fact. Everyone in the arches knew it. Mother mostly won't be fucking bullied. Not by Styrians, not by Kingsmen, not by anyone. So she shouldered through the crowd, skirts gathered up and tucked into her belt, the way she did when there was work to do. She jostled her way to the front, which one way or another she'd been doing all her life, using her elbows and her fixed jaw and her great loud voice.
Out of my way!
Forced a path through the big men, the armed men, the armoured men, still loitering. They might be hard on the outside, but they were soft where it counted. Mother mostly hadn't been born with much softness in her, and life in the laundries had pared away what there was and left her as yielding as a length of wire. She shoved onto the empty bridge, giving the towering gatehouse and its notched battlements and its slitted windows the kind of baleful frown she gave to folk owed her money.
"I'm a woman of the Union," she roared. 50 years, and I've worked every one of them. I won't be bullied, you hear?"
Cheers and jeers behind her, whoops and hoots, like folk watching freaks dance at a sideshow.
"Bring out that Styrian cunt,"
she screamed at the battlements, shaking her knife.
"The king's mother."
"She ain't there," someone called from behind.
"Scurried back to Styria months ago."
Mother mostly glowered up at the gatehouse, still a blur, more or less, but she knew there must be men up there, and she wasn't about to be bullied by the bastards. She took another step forward.
"Then bring out her cunt of a son, the king!"
Rithinghorm pressed his mouth to the arrow loop and bellowed at the very top of his voice,
"Halt! In the name of His Majesty!"
He leaned back to survey the results. Those words had always worked magic before, conjuring obedience from thin air. But now, suddenly, the spell had no effect.
"I order you to bloody halt!"
He doubted the crowd could even hear him over their clamour. He could hardly hear himself over his own thudding heart. Earlier that week, Lord Marshal Ruxted had addressed their regiment, told them that they were the last line of defence, told them failure was unthinkable, retreat impossible. Rithinghorm had always admired Ruxted. Excellent beard, lots of dash, the very style of officer he wanted to be. But the man had looked positively dishevelled, beard in disarray. Now Rithinghorm knew why. People continued to flood from the buildings on the other side of the moat and into an ever thicker press at the end of the bridge. Breakers, traitors, here at the very gates of the Agrient. And so many, he could scarcely credit it. They were starting to move out onto the bridge itself. One in particular leading the way. Some dirty, bloody peasant woman with her skirt tucked into her belt so her pale, sinewy legs showed, waving a knife, screeching words he could scarcely hear. Something about someone's son.
"Inconceivable," whispered Rithinghorm.
If he had read it in one of his sister's storybooks, he would have dismissed it as a fantasy. They had to be kept away from the gate. They had to be cleared from the bridge. They had to be taught a damn lesson. He pointed towards that shrieking woman.
"Shoot her!"
"Sir," said Parry, blinking. Damn, his mouth was dry. Kept having to lick his lips.
Captain Rithinghorm came close to point through the arrow loop, close enough that Parry could hear his breath echoing in the narrow chain room, close enough that he could smell him. He must wear some kind of perfume, hint of lavender. He pointed down, white with anger, down towards that laundry woman.
I said, shoot her!
Parry licked his lips again. Beau was ready, he'd made sure of that, or his hands had done it for him, following the old routine. He sighted up, nice and careful. Strangest thing, she reminded Parry of his mother. She used to tuck her skirts in like that when she was mopping floors.
Shoot, then!
Parry wanted to follow orders, always followed them before, but his hand wouldn't let go the string. The woman was coming closer, screeching away. That reminded him of his mother, too. Folk were starting to follow her example, edging out onto the bridge towards the gate. He licked his lips again. Just didn't seem right to shoot that woman. Slowly, Parry lowered his bow.
What are you doing?
Parry took the arrow from the string and, not sure what to do with it, put it behind his back.
Doesn't seem right, he said.
Rithinghorm seized him by the jacket.
I gave you an order.
I know.
Everyone was looking at them now.
I'm very sorry, sir.
Rithinghorm started to shake him.
Are you a damned traitor?
Parry could only swallow and blink and grip that arrow tight behind his back and shake his head.
I don't think so.
He honestly wasn't sure.
Just doesn't seem right.
Rithinghorm threw him back against the wall, jaw muscles squirming on the sides of his taut face.
Sergeant Hope!
Sir, said the sergeant. Rithinghorm pointed a stabbing finger at Parry.
Kill this man!
Sergeant Hope stared down at his drawn short sword. A long slit of light from one of the arrow loops making the broad blade glint in the shadows. He'd have followed his old captain into hell. He had done, out in Styria. But not this little fucker. This little bastard with his fine accent and his pale face and his thin fingers and his bloody perfume, ordering good men killed, ordering the citizens of Adua shot at. It came to him that he had more in common with those breakers chanting outside on the bridge than he did with Rithinghorm. They were just people. People who wanted to be heard. People who wanted enough to get by, while others had so much more than they could ever need. 20 years he'd been doing as he was told. Never seen another way. But just like that, sharp as fingers snapped under his nose, he decided to stop.
No,
he said. Rithinghorm gave a strange sort of hoot, mouth and eyes wide with surprise, when the short sword slid into his well-pressed uniform jacket. Hope dragged the blade back, and Rithinghorm plucked weakly at his shoulder, cheeks puffed right out. Hope shoved him away, lifted the sword, and hacked it into Rithinghorm's skull. Blood spattered. It's always a surprise how much a man holds. He blinked at his captain's corpse for a moment. He felt light-headed. He felt light all over. As if a fully laden pack had been snatched from his shoulders. Through the slitted windows, he could see the bridge was a solid press of people. He could hear the gates creaking below under the pressure. He turned to the men. They were staring at him, Parry and all the rest. So young they were. Good lads. Could he ever have looked that young when he first joined? They didn't know what to say, what to do. Hope didn't know either, but they had to do something. He pointed towards the stair.
Guess we'd better open the gates.
Smiler heard the clonk of the bar, the rattle of bolts, then the gates gave under the pressure, and people surged forwards like a river in spate through a burst dam. Folk pressed against him so tight he struggled not to prick 'em by accident with the spike on the back of his warhammer. There was a maid there, bonnet skewed across her face. There was a man, might have been a wheelwright or a cooper. There was a fellow looked no better than a beggar. Citizens of Adua picked up that day, citizens of the Union picked up in their march across Middleland, all mixed in with the First Breakers Regiment, men like Smiler, who'd fought in the wars in Styria, then in the bread riots in Kelm, then struggled in the mills in Valbeck, then been armed with Angland steel and marched to free themselves from tyranny. Now, all that sacrifice and struggle were finally bearing fruit. The great change come at last. They tumbled eagerly up the tunnel into the rotten heart of the old order, into the Agriant, grand buildings rising up on every side, into the Square of Marshals, where once, as a boy, Smiler came to watch the summer contest and screamed his lungs raw as Jezal Dan Luther beat Bremer Dan Gorst in the final. There were swords here today as well. A double line of soldiers strung across the square, crooked and hastily gathered, shields and weapons at all angles, an officer shouting in a broken voice. The breakers charged, didn't need an order. They couldn't have stopped, even if they'd wanted to. There was so much shoving from behind. The whole people's army at their backs. Every ground-down worker in the Union. But Smiler didn't want to stop. He wanted to smash this whole corrupt place. These grasping bastards who'd sent his friends to die in Styria, to die in the mills, to die in the cellars. He wanted to burn away the rot and make a country for its people. Smiler picked out a man to charge at, peeking over the top of his shield with desperate eyes. He let go a roar of hate, of joy, of triumph, the flagstones flying under his feet, the brothers surging to freedom all around him. Their shields crashed together. They struggled and strained, and Smiler got a glimpse of the man's bared teeth and his wide eyes. Then suddenly the pressure was gone, and he was stumbling forwards, and he saw Roy's had swung his halberd and staved the man's helmet in. It was a slaughter, really. The Royalists were already breaking, and they scurried away towards the great statues at the far end of the square, and men charged after them, whooping and screaming, leaving Smiler to stare down at the dead soldier with the dented helmet. Came to him then how easily he could have been in that line, if things had worked out just a little different. If he'd stayed in the army when they came back from Styria, instead of walking away in disgust. There was only a coin toss between him and these corpses.
"You're a hero!"
And a woman with a strong chin and her hair bound in a red scarf craned up to plant a great soft kiss on his jaw.
"You're all bloody heroes!"
The soldier blinked down at her, his helmet skewed, surprised, she thought, but not disappointed. So long since Adnes last kissed a man, she didn't know how to tell. But it wasn't a romantic thing so much as joy at having hope again. Or maybe it was a romantic thing, because he grabbed her around the back of the head and kissed her on the mouth, and she clung on to him, which was uncomfortable on account of the hardness of his breastplate, and there was a great warmth right through her, and she was sucking greedily at his tongue, which tasted of onions, and a fine taste it was too. She never would have dreamed she might kiss a stranger like that, but it was a new day, and the king's men were beaten, and all the old rules were gone, and the sun showed through again and made the soldiers' armour glitter, made the little puddles on the flagstones sparkle. Was this freedom? They were dragged apart by the flood of cheering people, then shoved back together, carried across the Square of Marshals and up the grand steps of the Lord's Round through the inlaid doors. Adnes stared up to the dome, high, high above, and around her, in the vast and heavy silence, hundreds of people who never thought in their lives to pass through those doors did the same. She looked at the gilding and the different coloured marbles and the rare woods and the suns stitched into the cushions on the benches and the stained glass windows that showed scenes she didn't understand. A bald man holding out a crown, a bearded man with a sword standing over two others, a young man lit by a ray of sun as he stood up alone from a crowd. The spotless grandeur of the place. Nothing could be further from the farm she'd left when the People's Army came through, where they'd slept on straw on the floor of a shack and worn their hands to the meat and been treated by the local lordling like they were less than dirt. Well, they were the masters now. They carried Rizenau in on a gilded chair they must have torn from some chamber, some office, some hall. Adnes grabbed at a leg of it, one in a forest of hands, helping it pass, and Rizenau laughed, and they laughed, and the joyous crowd cheered as they carried him bobbing down the aisle between the curved benches and set him on the great table. Folk had got up to the public gallery and were singing and clapping, the echoes of their joy bouncing about the great space and bringing it alive like it couldn't have been since that dome was raised. There was a flower girl up there, and she had a sack of petals and was throwing handfuls down, fluttering like butterflies through the shafts of coloured light to carpet the tiles below, and Adnes had never seen so beautiful a thing. Made her think of her husband's grave, and her son's graves down in the wood where the wildflowers grew, and that brought a blur of tears to her eyes. So much joy and so much pain together, she thought her chest would split with it.
"You have brought the dream to life, my friends," roared Rizenau, and there was a cheer so loud it made Adnes's teeth rattle and her ears ring and her heart throb.
"Rizenau!"
people squealed.
"Rizenau!"
And Adnes made a great sobbing, meaningless wail, reaching out towards him.
"Equality, my brothers! Unity, my sisters! A new beginning! A country governed by all in the interests of all! You will say on your deathbeds with a smile, that you were here, the day the Lord's Round was made the Commons Round, the day of the great change."
She was crying, and all about her men and women were crying and laughing all at once. It was the day their dreams came true, the day their new union was born. The soldier caught her hand, and there were tears on his face too, but he was smiling. He'd a fine smile, she thought.
"I don't know your name."
"Who cares a shit?"
And she dragged his helmet off so she could push her fingers through his sweaty hair and started kissing him again. Ettenbeck slipped from a side door of the Lord's Round and into a narrow street behind the building. He had thought he would be safe in there. Where could be safer than the very heart of the Union? But now the breakers were inside. He could hear them cheering. He could hear them crashing through the buildings all about him. Perhaps this was how it had been when the Gurkish invaded and the Eaters broke into the Agriant. He remembered his uncle telling him the story, his watery eyes fixed on the far distance as though at horrors beyond imagining. But these were not cannibal sorcerers, not inhuman and unknowable demons, not the wielders of forbidden powers, just ordinary people. A window shattered in the Commission for Land and Agriculture, and a desk came flying through, crashing to the ground not far away. Ettenbeck could feel the sweat running down his scalp, leaking out of him as if he was a squeezed sponge. It took every vestige of self-control he had not to break into a desperate sprint. The walls of the palace compound might still hold firm. Perhaps if he could make it there.
"There's one!"
He heard footsteps clapping from the buildings.
"Stop him!"
Now he ran, But not far. Someone caught him under the arm and threw him down. A flash of a bearded face, armor that looked new forged. He was dragged up again by the elbow. A strange gang, like the people you might see at one of the cheap markets, only furious. And Ettenbeck realized that ordinary people can be utterly terrifying.
"Where are you going, fucker?"
growled a man with a scar on his chin.
"It's no escaping the people's justice," squealed a woman and slapped him across the face. "We're in charge now."
He could hardly understand their grinding accents. He did not know what they wanted, did not know what he could possibly give them.
"My name is Ettenbeck,"
he said, for no reason that made any sense. They shoved him onwards. His cheek was burning. There were other prisoners caught up in the crowd, administrators, bureaucrats, clerks, a couple of soldiers, herded like animals, prodded along with spears. A grinning coachman was flicking at them with his carriage whip, making them howl and whimper. Ettenbeck knew one man's bloody face, but his name had gone. All their names had gone.
"Profiteers!" someone was screaming in a broken voice. "Speculators!"
A dark-skinned fellow was being kicked along the street, and he would stumble up and be kicked down again, up and down. Ettenbeck thought he was an ambassador from somewhere. Kadir, maybe? A charming, cultured man. Ettenbeck had heard him speak very movingly to the Solar Society about closer cooperation across the Circle Sea. Now they had knocked his hat off and were spitting on him.
"Bastard!"
snarled a man in soldier's clothes who had stripped his jacket off, his shirt spotted with blood.
"Bastard!"
And he stamped on the ambassador's head. Something hit Ettenbeck on the side of his face and he fell. The ground cracked him hard. He wobbled up to his hands and knees. His jaw was throbbing.
"Oh,"
he muttered, blood pattering on the cobbles.
"Oh dear."
A tooth fell out of his numb mouth. He was caught by the elbow again, dragged up again, pain shooting through his armpit, and sent stumbling on.
"Profiteers!"
a woman shrieked, spit spraying, eyes bulging, pointing at him with a rolling pin.
"Speculators! He's one of those closed council bastards!"
"I'm just a clerk!"
Ettenbeck's voice was a desperate squeal. It was a lie. He was one of the senior undersecretaries for agricultural taxation. How proudly he had murmured the title to himself when he received the promotion. His sister would finally have to take him seriously. How he wished now he had never even come to Adua, let alone to the Agrient. "But you'll buy nothing with wishes," as his mother always loved to say. He kicked and twisted as they dragged him across the little square in front of the land registry building towards the fountain. An ugly thing, a wide, waist-high stone bowl of water with a twisting mass of spouting stone fish rising from the centre. It was by no means improved by a corpse draped over the rim, arse in the air, and the pointed toes of fashionable shoes scraping the flagstones. Ettenbeck realized they were dragging him up next to the body.
"Wait!"
he squealed, and he caught the stone basin, spray splashing in his face, thrashing desperately, but there were hands all around him. One of his legs was lifted, the other shoe falling off as it scuffed on the ground. Someone caught the back of his head.
"One last drink at the people's expense, counselor!"
And they shoved his face into the water. Through the gurgle of the fountain, he heard shouting, singing, laughing. He fought his way up, just for a moment, gasped in a breath, saw the mad crowd surging on towards the House of Questions. They shook swords and spears in the air. One had a severed head spiked on it, bobbing obscenely over the mob. Absurd, like a cheap prop in a badly produced play. Except it was real. He was shoved down again into the fountain, bubbles rushing.